1 Samuel 14:16 through 14:23. The 10th talk in a series on 1 Samuel was presented by David Crabtree on October 28, 2007 at Reformation Fellowship.
The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2007. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
We're looking at 1 Samuel chapter 14, last half of it. I generally have difficulty estimating how much I'll say in the time allotted. But my guess is that this will not take the whole time. But I don't want to start the next section because it's all a unit. And so I'll just finish out chapter 14 and stop there. And we'll go till their questions and comments are done. And if we get done a little early, then we get done a little early. And the people taking care of kids will be very happy. I talked about the first part of chapter 14 in 1 Samuel last week. And in that section, Jonathan, the son of Saul, took some initiative and attacked a Philistine outpost, climbed up a cliff, he and his armor bearer, and the two of them killed 20 Philistines, and that caused a panic within the Philistine army. And it's in that state of panic then that we pick up the action in verse 16 of 1 Samuel 14. Now Saul's watchmen in Gibeah of Benjamin looked, and behold, the multitude melted away, and they went here and there. And Saul said to the people who were with him, "Number now and see who has gone from us." And when they had numbered, behold, Jonathan and his armor-bearer were not there. Then Saul said to Ahijah, "Bring the ark of God here," for the ark of God was at that time with the sons of Israel. And it happened, while Saul talked to the priest, that the commotion in the camp of the Philistines continued and increased. So Saul said to the priest, "Withdraw your hand." Then Saul and all the people who were with him rallied and came to the battle. And behold, every man's sword was against his fellow, and there was very great confusion. Now the Hebrews who were with the Philistines previously, who went up with them all around in the camp, even they also turned to be with the Israelites who were with Saul and Jonathan. When all the men of Israel who had hidden themselves in the hill country of Ephraim heard that the Philistines had fled, even they also pursued them closely in the battle. So the Lord delivered Israel that day, and the battle spread beyond Beth-Avon. So chaos, after Jonathan killed the 20 Philistines on the lookout on top of the cliff, the much larger camp of Philistines is thrown into chaos. The whole army is thrown into chaos. The watchmen of the Israelites are apparently stationed outside of Gibeah, but they can see Michmash from there. They're probably on some hills that are about a mile from Gibeah, and that is another 2 miles from Michmash, at least. So they're seeing it from quite a distance, but they're seeing chaos. They're seeing a lot of people running around and a lot of disorder, and they report that to Saul. It's interesting, Saul's first guess is that maybe some Israelite has been involved in doing this. So he has the soldiers muster up so they can determine if there are any Israelites that are missing. And so they muster up. Saul likes counting his men. They muster up, and it is determined that there are two soldiers missing. Those two soldiers are Jonathan and his armor-bearer. So he's able to identify the ones who have apparently sparked this chaos within the Philistine camp. So Saul says, bring the ark here. Whenever Saul is contemplating the possibility of attacking the Philistines, he always wants to consult. He always wants to get a word from God that this is the thing that he is to do. This time he says, bring the ark. That's a little tricky. The ark that he's talking about is the Ark of the Covenant. The Ark of the Covenant had been at, I think at this time it's been at Gilgal for some time. And there's no indication that the ark has left Gilgal except for this particular verse. In some manuscripts, it doesn't say ark here. It says the ephod. We know that the ephod is here. That has been mentioned before, that it said that the priest was with Saul and he had the ephod. Now, nobody knows exactly what the ephod is. It's some kind of garment that the priest wore. And it had two pockets in it, one for the Urim and one for the Thummim. The Urim and Thummim it's some kind of, and nobody knows exactly what those are either, but it's apparently two coin-like things, and they use the Urim and Thummim to get a word from God. A question would be asked, a yes or no question would be asked, and depending on how these fell or something, the priest would know what God's response was. So we know the ephod was with them. The only question is whether the ark was there as well. The manuscripts, and most of the manuscripts have the ark, if that reading is correct, then the ephod and the ark are present there, and the ark wouldn't have the same significance as far as getting a word from God. But the ark is the most religiously significant item that the Israelites have. So I'm not sure whether the original text would have said ark or whether it would have said ephod. It seems to me the ephod is more likely. The word ark and the word ephod are different by two letters, but those two letters are very similar. So it's easy. They could have been confused. In any case, Saul has asked for the priest to come and for the priest to give some kind of indication from God as to whether the Israelite army ought to enter into this chaos and fight the Philistines. The priest responds and comes and begins to do his thing, whatever that is, whether he's throwing the Urim and Thummim up in the air or whatever he's doing. But he starts doing his thing to get God's response. And the commotion builds. There's more and more unrest that's visible in the Israelite camp. And it reaches the point where Saul says to the priest, withdraw your hand. Apparently what he's indicating to the priest is, stop. You don't need to consult with God. It's clear what we are to do. And Saul calls the people to himself. And rallies them and tells them to go out to battle. The commotion that has arisen is widespread within the camp of the Philistines. It is a commotion that was sparked by Jonathan, but Jonathan isn't apparently involved anymore. It was started and now it's taking off and it has a life of its own. It says that every man's sword was against his fellow. So they're fighting against them each other within the Philistine camp. And in 21 it says, now the Hebrews who were with the Philistines previously, who went up with them all around in the camp, even they also turned to be with the Israelites who were with Saul and Jonathan. Now the word Hebrews, or Hebrew, we see it a number of times in the Old Testament, but this word also appears in extra-biblical literature, and so we have some idea what that word means. The Hebrews in the ancient world, or the Abiru, is the way that it's is the way that that word shows up in other languages of the ancient Near East. It was a group of people that was not necessarily an ethnic group. That is to say, they weren't necessarily related by blood. They were related by culture. They seem to have been people who were kind of outcasts from the surrounding peoples. They band together and form their own culture. So it's similar to, as I understand it, in American history, in Indian history, the Apaches were made up the same kind of way. That the Apaches were not all related by bloodlines, but rather they were Indians that had been outcasts from other tribes, and they gathered together and formed their own group. Well, the Abiru seem to be that kind of phenomenon. And we see they show up in the ancient literature at various places, but most frequently their name is associated with mercenary soldiers. So these Abiru apparently hired themselves out to fight for other people as a very common occupation for them. Now, it's unclear what the connection is between the Abiru and the Israelites. Sometimes the Israelites refer to themselves, are referred to by others sometimes as Hebrews. So apparently the Israelites fit into this general cultural phenomenon of Abiru. The Israelites seem to be a subset of that larger group. And so that's the word that is used by others to refer to the Israelites. Occasionally the Israelites will use it to refer to themselves, but very rarely, and we saw one instance in the last passage. So in this passage, it's not clear whether these Hebrews are Israelites or whether they are just mercenary soldiers from that cultural group. It's just not clear. But in any case, these were people who had been fighting for the Philistines and had been trusted by the Philistines. They're moving through the camps, moving with the Philistines. They're trusted by the Philistines, and now, as a result of what Jonathan has done and the chaos that has been generated, now they have turned against the Philistines that they had been fighting for previously. Not only that, but the Israelites, who, when they heard of the Philistines gathering together, had all fled for cover, gone into caves, gone into holes, gone in wherever they could find shelter, had gone into hiding. Now that they see the commotion among the Philistines, they are coming out of hiding. They've been emboldened, and now they are going out against the Philistines as well. So what Jonathan did, what Jonathan and his armor bearer did, by taking initiative, acting very bravely, climbing up the cliff and killing the 20 Philistines that were on top of that cliff. By doing that one act, they have sparked a large rebellion within the Philistine army. Something that I don't think Jonathan could have foreseen. He didn't know what the outcome would be of that which he has done. But the outcome, in fact, is the Philistines are in absolute chaos and killing one another. So it says in the last verse, "So the Lord delivered Israel that day, and the battle spread beyond Beth Avon." God was the one who provided the deliverance. It is not attributed to Jonathan and his action, but rather this was God's doing, very clearly so. And the battle spread well beyond anything that anyone could have anticipated. The next section. "Now the men of Israel were hard pressed on that day, for Saul had put the people under oath, saying, 'Cursed be the man who eats food before evening, and until I have avenged myself on my enemies. So none of the people tasted food, and all the people of the land entered the forest, and there was honey on the ground. When the people entered the forest, behold, there was a flow of honey, but no man put his hand to his mouth, for the people feared the oath. But Jonathan had not heard when his father put the people under oath. Therefore he put out the end of the staff that was in his hand and dipped it in the honeycomb and put his hand to his mouth, and his eyes brightened. Then one of the people answered and said, "Your father strictly put the people under oath, saying, 'Cursed be the man who eats food today.'" And the people were weary. Then Jonathan said, "My father has troubled the land. See now how my eyes have brightened because I tasted a little of this honey. How much more if only the people had eaten freely today of the spoil of their enemies, which they found? For now the slaughter among the Philistines has not been great." Apparently, before Saul sent the Israelites out to battle, he had them take an oath. He had them take an oath that they would not eat until evening. It is unclear to me why Saul would have had them take such an oath. And I tried to think of reasons, and maybe you guys can think of better reasons than I can. Possibly he wanted them to be focused on the task, not thinking about eating, but rather thinking about the job at hand, that is dealing a blow to the Philistines. It's possible that he's thinking, "I don't want any delays. I don't want people spending time gathering and preparing food. I want them to spend their time killing Philistines." One commentator suggested that his purpose was more religious. That is, by this act of self-denial, of not eating, that they would be more likely to gain the favor of God, that they are making this sacrifice in exchange for God's favor in their endeavor. In the context of other things that Saul has done, I think that the last one might be the more likely, that there might be a kind of sense that this is a religious act that is designed to gain favor from God. In any case, that's what he swore them to do. They all took that oath, and as we'll see, it's a self-defeating oath that he had them take. They're fighting the Philistines, and we can tell from the text that this battle goes 20 miles beyond where it started before the day is done. I don't know how far the Israelites went, but they are probably running and fighting throughout the day. And they come into the forest area, and there is honey on the ground. And I don't know why that would be. I don't know whether nests have fallen. I don't know if there are bees that make honey in the ground and that would be exposed. I don't know what the case is. But in any case, there is honey that is visible right there on the forest floor. The Israelites are afraid to touch it because of the oath that they had made. And it is interesting that it's their fear of the oath. It says, "For the people feared the oath." So it's the oath itself that they're in fear of, not their fear of God, the one behind the oath. Jonathan has apparently rejoined them. And he's with the Israelites. He's going into the forest. He sees the honey. He was not there when the oath was taken, so he doesn't know that the oath was taken. So he sees an opportunity to get some food. He sticks his staff in the honey, and he eats that honey. Other Israelites see him doing that, and they are scared. This is a terrifying thing. Jonathan has just broken the oath that the Israelites had taken. So they tell him, "We took an oath not to eat, and you're eating." And Jonathan's response is very interesting. He says, 29, then Jonathan said, my father has troubled the land. See now how my eyes have brightened because I tasted a little of this honey. How much more if only the people had eaten freely of the spoil of their enemies, which they found. For now the slaughter among the Philistines has not been great. There have been some indications earlier that there is, to one degree or another, a bit of tension between Saul and Jonathan. Remember back to the last passage, Jonathan didn't tell Saul that he's going to go up against the Philistines. So Saul didn't know. That was all on Jonathan's initiative. And here, when Jonathan hears what Saul has had the people swear, he sees it as a bad thing immediately. That Saul has done a bad thing to Israel. He has hampered the cause by making them swear this oath. And as a result of having them make this oath, the very opposite of what Saul had intended is going to happen. Saul wanted the slaughter among the Philistines to be great. That's why he made them take the oath. But Jonathan is pointing out, because he made them take that oath, they can't keep up their physical stamina, and the slaughter will be less than it otherwise would have been. Next section. And they struck among the Philistines that day from Michmash to Aijalon, and the people were very weary. And the people rushed greedily upon the spoil, and took sheep and oxen and calves, and slew them on the ground, and the people ate them with the blood. Then they told Saul, saying, behold, the people are sinning against the Lord by eating with the blood. And he said, you have acted treacherously. Roll a great stone to me today. And Saul said, disperse yourselves among the people, and say to them, each one of you, bring me his ox or his sheep, and slaughter it here, and eat, and do not sin against the Lord by eating with the blood. So all the people that night brought each one his ox with him, and slaughtered it there. And Saul built an altar to the Lord. It was the first altar that he built to the Lord. So the battle continues throughout the day until evening. They fight from Michmash, where the Philistines had started, all the way to Aijalon, which is about 20 miles away. So this battle spread far and wide. It says, and the people were very weary. Earlier it had said the people were weary. So we're getting the sense here that the people are weary. And probably hungry as well. They did wait until evening. They didn't eat until the evening came, just as they had taken the oath to do. But when evening comes, they are absolutely famished. And as a result, they kill animals and eat them immediately. They eat them so immediately that they don't allow the blood to drain out of the animals before they eat them. And in the commandments that God had given to Moses on Sinai, one of the things that they were commanded was to drain the blood from animals before they eat the meat. So this is a violation of the commandments that God had given to the Israelites. And so this is reported to Saul that the people are eating flesh with the blood still in it. And Saul is outraged because they are sinning. So he asked them, oh, and by the way, it says that they kill them on the ground. So rather than even getting them on a stone and cutting them and letting the blood drain out, they're killing them right where they are on the ground. Saul says, bring me a stone. And apparently he wants to use that stone as a place, a table on which to slay the animals and drain the blood. So he takes control and has them bring the animals to make sure that it is done correctly and that the blood is all drained out. They do so. And then verse 35, And Saul built an altar to the Lord. It was the first altar he had built to the Lord. A curious verse. It's not real clear how this connects in. Generally speaking, throughout the Old Testament, when the patriarchs would build an altar, it would be in commemoration or recognition of some kind of encounter with God. Something of significance that God had done. And they would build an altar as a way of recognizing what God had done, both to memorialize it and to express their thanksgiving for that thing. So Saul is building an altar here, and presumably it's for the same purpose. It's a recognition of what God has done, both as a memorial and an act of thanksgiving. But it goes on to say this was the first altar that he had built to the Lord. A curious thing to point out. I think what we are to make of this is the first time that Saul has made recognition of what God has done. There have been other times that God has acted on Saul's behalf. He made him king, for one, and he had led him to victory against the Ammonites a couple chapters earlier. So there were a couple of other opportunities for Saul to do so, but this is the first time that he has done so. And I think the writer is trying to call our attention to the fact that this is the first time that he has acknowledged God's activity on his behalf. Next section. Then Saul said, "Let us go down after the Philistines by night and take spoil among them until the morning light, and let us not leave a man of them." And they said, "Do whatever seems good to you." So the priest said, "Let us draw near to God here." And Saul inquired of God, "Shall I go down after the Philistines? Wilt thou give them into the hand of Israel?" But he did not answer him on that day. And Saul said, "Draw near here, all you chiefs of the people, and investigate and see how this sin has happened today. For as the Lord lives, who delivers Israel, though it is in Jonathan my son, he shall surely die." But not one of all the people answered him. Then he said to all Israel, "You shall be on one side, and I and Jonathan my son on the other side." And the people said to Saul, "Do what seems good to you." Therefore Saul said to the Lord, the God of Israel, "Give a perfect lot." And Jonathan and Saul were taken, but the people escaped. And Saul said, "Cast lots between me and Jonathan my son." And Jonathan was taken. Saul realizes, although it's already evening, it's getting dark, Saul realizes that he had a great opportunity to do a lot of damage to the Philistines. And because he had asked his people not to eat, they had been unable to inflict as many casualties as Saul had hoped. And now he's thinking, perhaps we should take advantage of this opportunity, even though it's nighttime. Let's go get them. And the people say, whatever you want to do, if that's what you want to do, we're game. But the priest says to Saul, "We better check with God." The priest and Saul are of like mind in this kind of thing. They both are very intent on checking with God before they do take this kind of action. So the priest consults with God, and there's no answer from God. And Saul knows what that means when there's no answer from God. That means that there has been a sin that has been committed that keeping God from responding. So Saul decides we have to figure out who committed that sin and deal with that sin in order to have the blessing of God on our activity. So they draw lots to figure out who it was that was the guilty person. And first it's drawn between Saul and Jonathan on one hand and the people on the other hand. And it's determined that it's not the people who are guilty in this. So it's either Saul or Jonathan. And a lot is drawn again, and it is Jonathan who is the one who is the guilty party. Even before the lots are drawn, Saul says, we've got to find the guilty party, and that guilty person will die, even if it's my son Jonathan, ironically. Okay, next section. Then Saul said to Jonathan, tell me what you have done. So Jonathan told him and said, I indeed tasted a little honey with the end of the staff that was in my hand. Here I am. I must die. And Saul said, may God do this to me and more also, for you shall surely die, Jonathan. So the people said to Saul, must Jonathan die, who has brought about this great deliverance in Israel? Far from it. As the Lord lives, there shall not one hair of his head fall to the ground, for he has worked with God this day. So the people rescued Jonathan, and he did not die. Then Saul went up from pursuing the Philistines, and the Philistines went to their own place. Now, it does not say what Jonathan was thinking here. It doesn't say what the people were thinking. There were Israelites who knew that Jonathan had eaten the honey. We know that from the previous text. But when Saul is trying to figure out who sinned, no one steps forward and said, well, I saw Jonathan eat some honey. No one does that. Nor does Jonathan step forward. Now, I don't know whether Jonathan is thinking, I'll just wait and see what happens here. It's possible that Jonathan is thinking, I'm innocent. I may have eaten honey, but I'm innocent of any wrongdoing. I'm not sure what he's thinking, but in any case, he doesn't volunteer anything. He waits until the lots are drawn. But when the lots are drawn, he is the one who is designated as the one who has sinned. And Saul asks Jonathan to say what he has done, and Jonathan admits that he ate of the honey. And at the end he says, here I am, I must die. It's not clear how he's saying this. It's possible that he's just saying, yep, I did that. That agreement was made that if any of the Israelites eat during the day, that person must die. So he may be just reconciling himself to that, even though he hasn't done anything intentionally that's wrong. The other possibility is he's asking a question. He's saying, do I really have to die? But in the Hebrew, you can't tell whether it's a question or not. It would all depend on intonation. We don't have the intonation. So he could be saying, do I really have to die? Or he could be saying something a bit more biting, kind of ironic, and saying, yeah, I did that, and I'm going to have to die because of the oath that my father had made the Israelites take. Now, I don't know exactly what his attitude and what the tone of voice is here, but there is tension between Jonathan and Saul. They don't see the world eye to eye. And I think that Jonathan sees Saul's religiosity as something less than genuine. That's certainly the way the author of 1 Samuel sees it. It's less than genuine. And it could be that Saul is observing that same thing. And that Saul's willingness to kill Jonathan for this is just showing the extremity of this non-genuine religiosity. And we can talk a little bit more about that later. The people intervene at this point, though, and they say, you can't kill him. That would be absurd. He wasn't in on taking the oath, and he was the one who took the action at the very beginning that got this started. He's the hero in this, and he was working with God. So they plead for him to be saved, and Saul relents and doesn't put him to death. So that ends the conflict. The Israelites do not go back out against the Philistines. The Philistines retreat to their territory, and the Israelites back off to their territory. And this ends that particular conflict. To finish out the chapter then, starting in 47. Now when Saul had taken the kingdom over Israel, he fought against all his enemies on every side, against Moab, the sons of Ammon, Edom, the kings of Zobab, and the Philistines. And wherever he turned, he inflicted punishment. And he acted valiantly and defeated the Amalekites and delivered Israel from the hands of those who plundered them. Now the sons of Saul were Jonathan and Ishvi and Malchishua, and the names of his two daughters were these: the name of the firstborn, Merab, and the name of the younger, Michal. And the name of Saul's wife was Ahinoam, the daughter of Ahimaaz. And the name of the captain of his army was Abner, the son of Ner, Saul's uncle. And Kish was the father of Saul, and Ner, the father of Abner, was the son of Abiel. Now the war against the Philistines was severe all the days of Saul. And when Saul saw any mighty man or any valiant man, he attached him to his staff. This section just wraps up then Saul's activity as he took control of the kingdom of the Israelites. He's fighting against all of those who have over the years, over the centuries, in fact, been afflicting the Israelites. And it says that he acted valiantly. So there are words of praise here for Saul. It's interesting that in this account, Saul is not only singled out for criticism. There are instances where he is singled out for praise. So he delivers Israel from the hands of those who had plundered them over many, many years. It then gives some genealogical information, and we won't go into that, but some of these names will pop up later in both 1 Samuel and 2 Samuel, and we'll come back to those. And then it concludes indicating that the war against the Philistines was severe all of the time of Saul's reign. And as a result, Saul was constantly interested in developing an army that could fight against these Philistines. So anybody that he saw that had potential of being a good soldier, he tapped that person and tried to enlist them in his ranks. So anytime he saw a mighty man or a valiant man, he hired him on. And that becomes kind of a segue into the introduction of David in two chapters. Okay, there are a couple of themes that are of significance here that I want to talk about. The first is Saul's religiosity is striking here. He is meticulous in wanting to consult with God before he goes into battle. He wants to make sure that God is on his side before he embarks on that kind of endeavor. He wants to ensure his success before he ventures out. We notice that before Jonathan went up against the Philistines initially, that Saul was consulting God with respect to whether they should go out against the Philistines or not. Then in the section that we just read, when the chaos breaks out in the Philistine camp, he wants to consult with God before they go out. And then on the third occasion in the evening, at the priest's prompting, but once again, Saul wants to consult with God before they go out against the Philistines. All of those religious acts, Saul is very concerned that he has God's favor before he takes that kind of action. Also, we notice that he builds an altar. It's the first ever that he has built, and I, I think that we are supposed to see that as kind of a criticism of Saul, but he does build an altar. And then he uses the holy vow as a way of trying to motivate his troops to defeat the Philistines completely. And we see that when it is determined that his son Jonathan is the one who had violated that oath, he is willing to take Jonathan's life for that. And I think we can take that seriously. I think he would have killed Jonathan. But the author of 1 Samuel, I think, is presenting all of this in a negative light. It's religiosity, but it's religiosity superstition. There's something perverse about it. And it is in striking contrast to Jonathan. And I think we are supposed to see a sharp contrast throughout this between Jonathan and Saul. And one of the parts of that contrast is Jonathan does virtually nothing religious in this passage at all. Jonathan is just trying to do what God wants him to do. He is open to God's leading, and he does it. But we don't see him doing the same kind of religious actions that his father does. And I think that in that last part where he says, now you've got to kill me, I think that's a criticism of Saul's religiosity, that it's come to this, that you would kill your innocent son because of your devotion to this religiosity. It is interesting, I think, that Saul's religiosity is born out of fear and insecurity, I believe, and we'll talk more about that later, but I think we see a pattern of that throughout Saul's life in the way that it's been depicted up to now. But Saul is very cognizant of his need for God's help. He knows that he needs divine favor. And he tries to secure that help with religious practices. But that is superstition. That's not true faith. His religiosity does not grow out of a heart of obedience. And we see that in the text as well, and we'll see that more next week. So I won't expand on that theme anymore, because that's really what the next chapter is all devoted to. But we're seeing the development of this, of Saul's religious perspective, I think. And then that will be further developed next week. The other thing I'd like to talk about is unintended consequences of our actions. There are two situations here in which there are unintended consequences that are, I think, we are intended to see contrasted. The first unintended consequence is the Philistines have turned on themselves and are fighting themselves, and in that way, God has brought about a destruction of the Philistines at their own hands. I don't think that there is any way that Jonathan could have predicted that his action would have led to that. Jonathan is just, he decides to take initiative. That is, he goes into Philistine territory. He sees an opportunity that seems to present itself. There's something that clues him, and I think, like I talked about last week, it's watching the behavior of the Philistines on top of the cliff. There's something about his behavior, about their behavior that he sees, that indicates that they may be vulnerable. He's not sure, so he decides, if they say, come up here, then that is another piece of evidence that indicates that they are vulnerable. I'm going to take advantage of it. If they say we're coming down, then I was wrong. What I thought was an opportunity is not an opportunity at all. They say come up here. So he takes advantage of that. He goes up, and he and his armor bearer kill the men on top of the cliff. All he is doing is trying to be obedient to God. And by so doing, the consequences of his actions are good to a degree that he could never have calculated, could never have foreseen. On the other hand, Saul had the Israelites take an oath that they would not eat anything until evening. That is doubly destructive. His reason for giving that command was so that they would wipe out the Philistines utterly. But by having made the Israelites take that oath, they are starving to death. They don't have the energy to pursue the Philistines. And furthermore, they are so hungry by the end of the day that they can't properly prepare the meat that they're going to eat before they eat it. And Saul puts them in a situation where they are bound to do wrong. I think it is an interesting phenomenon, and it is observable historically, I think, very often, that many times actions are taken by governments, we'll use governments to start with, actions are taken by governments that have the absolute opposite outcome from the intention that gave rise to that action. The first time I started thinking about this actually had nothing to do with government, but it was reading a book. And I know I've mentioned this before. Some of you will remember. Forgive me. It's Why Things Fight Back was the name of the book. The subtitle was The Unintended Consequences of Technology. And in the book, he gives one example after another of things that were done for a good reason, technological developments that were made for a good reason. But in the end, the result was just the opposite of what was intended. And there are lots of examples of it, but I will give you the one that's my favorite from the book, and it's the boxing glove. Boxing became very popular in the late 1800s, in the early 1900s, and they put two men in a ring, and they would start thumping on each other and beating each other until one of them emerged victorious. And it was observed that these were very bloody events, because as they would start hitting on each other, usually blows to the face would produce blood, either from the nose or the mouth or some way where blood would start flowing. So it was decided that the sport needed to be cleaned up and made more humane. So they decided that they would put these padded gloves on the fighters that would keep them from being bloody. And so now we have modern boxing with the gloves on the hands. And it is true now that in boxing matches, there is less blood. But before the gloves came on, there was a limit to how hard one would hit. Because if you hit really hard, you could break the bones in your hand, and that hand would be out of action. So you always had to pull your punch a little bit. You always had to hold back a little bit because you didn't want to break the bones in your hand. Put the gloves on. Now you don't have to hold back. Nobody holds back. So you hit as hard as you can. It produces less blood, but it's a harder blow, and it does more damage to the brain. So in an attempt to try to make the sport more humane, to clean it up, there's a sense in which boxing gloves achieved that. They cleaned it up. They made boxing prettier, more humane superficially. But in putting on the gloves, they made the sport ultimately more brutal and more damaging. Well, that's just one example of this kind of thing. He goes through and talks about lots and lots of examples like that, and we could amass any number of other examples. That's in the technological sphere, but it happens also in the sociological and political sphere. In fact, the inspiration for this book, Why Things Bite Back, was an essay that was written about the unintended consequences of social legislation. Take something like our welfare system, a thing that was designed with the best of intentions, that is, to try to get help to poor people so that they can climb out of their poverty. And time has shown that the efforts that the government has made have been not only unsuccessful in helping them to climb out of their poverty, but in many cases have made it more difficult for them to climb out of their poverty. Just the opposite effect of what was intended. I noticed something just the other day. This is another example, a trivial example, but nevertheless humorous. I have noticed that in parking lots now, they are making the spaces smaller and smaller. I'm assuming, I don't know this, but I'm assuming that the thought behind it is, let's cram more cars into smaller space so we don't have to pave as much of Eugene. I pulled into a parking lot at a grocery store recently where they do have the narrow parking places, and I saw three SUVs parked. Each one of them didn't feel like it could fit into one space, so it took two. So there were three SUVs occupying six parking spaces. It is interesting, it is important to recognize this phenomenon, that we need to recognize that life is very complicated. Reality is very complicated. There are a lot of factors that all come together to form any particular situation that we might find ourselves in. And as a result, it is difficult to predict what kind of action in that situation will necessarily result in the right kind of outcome. What Saul did by having them make the oath, it could be argued that was just stupidity. He should have been able to foresee the negative consequences of having the Israelites take that oath. I think that's plausible. But there are other instances where the unintended consequences, I would argue, are absolutely unforeseeable. It wouldn't matter how smart one was. We are just limited in understanding, and we have to be aware of that. I think of weather forecasting, especially living in the Northwest. They do seem to be getting better in their weather forecasts as time goes on. They get more equipment, they get faster computers, and they do seem to be getting a little bit better, but they still do not always get it right. And I know that they keep saying, all we need is a faster computer, a bigger, faster computer, and then we can nail the weather. Maybe they will be able to, maybe they won't. I remember in the Soviet Union, where they had a centralized economy, it didn't work very well. And they kept saying, if we just had a big enough computer, we could make this work. Well, I'm more optimistic about weather prognostications than I am about controlling the economy. Because with the weather, you're dealing with inert particles that act according to the laws of physics and chemistry. But when we talk about economics, or we talk about communities of people, now we're no longer talking about things as predictable as atoms. We're talking about things that are that vary greatly for reasons that we can't all determine. As a result, I think that it is impossible ultimately to predict human behavior in particular human behavior in large groups. And no computer will be able to do that. So that makes it really difficult to know what action to take in a complex, in a society, what kinds of laws would be beneficial and have the right kind of impact. In fact, it's even hard to know what you need to achieve with those laws. Just stepping back even a step from how to achieve your goals, the question is, what goals are the right kinds of goals to have? In light of this reality, it seems to me that there's only one approach that makes sense, and that is we need to humbly do what we think is best. In any given situation, what seems to be the best thing to do, that's what we ought to do, but recognizing how very limited our understanding is. We could be very wrong at any point in time. And be open to God's leading and steering us, sending us in another direction. Because ultimately, we need God to take care of those outcomes. God can make those outcomes whatever he wants them to be, even if we can't foresee what those outcomes will be. He knows what they should be, and he knows how to get there. We don't know either of those very clearly. So we're just here kind of bumbling around, but we need to bumble humbly. Humble bumblers. And be open to God, steering us and doing what he's going to do. It's arrogance that gets us into trouble. It's thinking that we can know what we can't know. Okay. I went longer than I thought I would, but there's a little bit of time left.
This Old Testament stuff brings up a long-term question for me, is that more or less being raised in the church, I was never taught to discern, discriminate, understand the difference between that part of the Bible which is written as history and that part of the Bible which is written as what came to be known as doctrine. Mm-hmm. How do you, in your process, protect yourself from that mistake? The difference between the author saying, this is what happened, and the author encouraging to go and do likewise, so to speak. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Well, that is not easy. That's a very difficult thing to divide. But I think that, well, first of all, just because someone did it doesn't mean that that's prescribed for me. We have to sort out, how is the author presenting it? Is the author presenting it as something that is good and emulable? Or is he presenting it as something that is not emulable? So sorting out, what is the author's perspective? Why is he even talking about this? And what are we supposed to derive from this is a critical question. And sometimes that's easy to do, and sometimes that's very difficult to do. I think we'll see with respect to Saul in this next chapter, it becomes quite clear, because Samuel speaks up and gives his commentary on Saul, and I take that to be an authoritative commentary on Saul and what Saul has done. So that's one issue. The other issue then is, even if the author presents it as emulable, to what degree is it distinctive to Israel? But there are those things that are distinctive to Israel that are not true for us. And that is also a difficult thing, I think, to sort out. There are things that are distinctive about Israel and the history of Israel. My sense is that that's particularly true in the way that God dealt with Israel as a nation. God did things in Israel that he will never do in America. God made promises to Israel that he has never made to America. God interacted with Israel as a nation in a way that I think he will never interact with us as a nation. It seems to me, however, that when it when it's God dealing with individuals, that for the most part, what he did, the way that he related to individuals in the Old Testament is the way that he relates to us. Now, even that I would back off from a little bit, in that God seems to have been more willing to be more overt in his dealings with the Israelites. For instance, he spoke to Moses. So there are ways that he was more overt in the Old Testament, but I think the essential interaction between God and an individual in the Old Testament is the same as the essential interaction that he has with us now. Did I answer your question? I'll call that good.
I had basically the same question, and I guess I just want you to maybe confirm, if you will. I've read the Bible thinking that everything is, you know, everything that it says is some, in way, if it's not condemned, it's prescribed, if you will. So the way that Saul acted, that was, it doesn't condemn it. It doesn't, the author never says Saul shouldn't have made them take this oath not to eat. It's, well, he's the king. He did it, and it didn't say he shouldn't have done it. So, you know, on a casual reading, if you hadn't picked up all the consequences, mm-hmm. you know, that's seen as a good thing. And I think I've even heard those sort of things preached on in other churches, you know, that, you know, doing this religiosity sort of thing before the Lord is good. And it's just amazing that that mm-hmm. may not be the case. So my question was similar to Logan's, is how do you, as a reader, discern what's different? And I think you already answered that, yeah. but can you just yeah. speak to the way the Old Testament is written?
Yeah.
In that regard?
Well, I think the key to understanding the Old Testament narratives is to, as much as possible, kind of immerse yourself into the text, such that you're trying to figure out, what are they thinking? Why are they doing what they are doing? Why does the author describe it this way and not some other way? That all of those are clues to what is going on. The text is always very sparse. There aren't many clues there. But the clues that are there need to be taken seriously. And I have read through 1 Samuel several times in the past. It had never struck me until this time, the extent to which Saul is a religious person. But now, as we get to the next chapter next week, I think it becomes really clear that the author has done that intentionally, because what he's going to talk about in the next chapter is what constitutes true religion. And that's where he's headed. That's where this whole section is headed. So if you string that together, you can see what the author is doing. And it all kinds of falls together. And when it falls together that way, then you can have confidence. I know what the text is doing here. I know what's going on.
Yeah, another, just you got to take it in context and read the whole thing.
Absolutely.
Again. You read one of those chapters, you think that that's what Saul is doing is commendable, and that's how a Christian should be, and
right.
you know, or whatnot.
No, that's absolutely true. I think people talk about context when they are referring to arguments in the New Testament, but context in the Old Testament narratives is at least as important, because you have to figure out why is the author even telling this story, and what do they see as good and bad, and why do they present the parts that they present, and why do they present the parts with the words that they use to present them? And it should be all pointing to something, a line of argument, essentially. And that's my assumption, is that that's the way it works. We've got to go. Thanks.